everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. So excited to be here with you. We have a great show for you today. Such a great lineup, such great guests. Really excited to be talking about all the quite scary things that are happening in the world. At least we can be together as we talk about them, and we can have great input and insights from our guests. Before I bring on the first guest, please make sure you give the thumbs up. You give this stream a like, hit the like button. Also, please subscribe. It's so exciting. We are at over 200,000 subscribers. So thank you so much to all of you who have subscribed. Share the stream, and you can also become YouTube members. You can also become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. You get all sorts of great bonus content if you pay $5 a month, which is basically, like, depending on where you live, it's kind of like a cup of coffee a month. And if you can't swing that, if you can only do the $1 a month, you are still helping make this show happen. So we really could not do this show without your support. So we're doing two sections for the show. During the second section, I'm going to be talking to two members of Veterans for Peace, Barry Raich and Matthew Ho. But first, I'm bringing on our first guest. She's returning to the Katie Helper Show. You guys really loved having her on, so she's back. Dr. Asal Rad is a scholar of Middle East history. She works on research and writing related to U.S. foreign policy issues, the Middle East and contemporary Iran. Her writing can be seen in Newsweek, The National Interest, The Independent, Foreign Policy, and more. And she has appeared as a commentator on BBC World, Al Jazeera, CNN, and NPR. She completed a PhD in history from the University of California, Irvine in 2018, and is the author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran. So Asal, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me back.
Of course. Wanted to ask you, before we get into what is happening right now with Iran and Israel, there's a lot of context that's been omitted from the media discussion, and you do such great media analysis. Can you fill people in on what happened before Iran engaged in this retaliatory strike?
Yeah, well, something to keep in mind is there's the acute timeline of what happened that led to that specific strike, but also there's this longer history of a shadow war between Israel and Iran. One thing that I think is important for people to know is, for instance, Israel has been carrying out assassinations of Iranian scientists and commanders, sabotage of its nuclear facilities for years, for more than a decade. And so the April 1st attack on an Iranian consulate in Damascus was not an entirely new situation in which you saw the killing of multiple IRGC commanders. But it was sort of unprecedented because of the location of the attack, which was an Iranian consulate, right? And the fact that, embassies are supposed to be protected. This was an embassy complex. It also did damage to a neighboring embassy. So that was the acute situation that prompted the specific reaction from Iran, which was what we saw over the weekend. A telegraphed attack by Iran. Iran had informed officials in Turkey, in Jordan, so that they knew, so that people, basically they knew 72 hours in advance that this was going to happen. Plus they had said it publicly many, many times. And that's one of the reasons why you saw basically all 99% of the drones and missiles being intercepted by mostly the U.S., but also Israel and help from Jordan. So this particular action by Iran is unprecedented because it is the first time within this shadow war where it's much more in the open, and the first time Iran has actually carried out an attack on Israeli soil. That's why I think we see this heightened level of tensions, but also to keep in mind that the context in which all of this is happening right now is within the larger context of the war on Gaza, right? Israel's war on Gaza, and why the idea that Israel would want to sort of distract from that, which in certain ways it's been successful at doing, by creating this posture of defense now with Iran's attack, and distracting from its actual campaign in Gaza, which is the larger reason why we have so much tension in the region to begin with.
It's quite stunning the way Israel goes around killing people, facing no condemnation, no consequences. As you mentioned, I mean, Iranian scientists, which is pretty scary that they're just allowed to do that. I guess it shouldn't be surprising by now. But you actually, as always, you have an interesting critique of the media's representation of the news. So let's take a look at a tweet that you wrote as you watch Western media cover around retaliatory attack as a major escalation and the fear of a larger war. Remember, this is how they covered Israel's embassy attack that prompted the retaliation. International norms don't work if you apply them selectively. And then let's see, you have a screenshot of the New York Times, which wrote on its headline, "Israel bombed an Iranian embassy complex. Is that allowed? Israel can likely argue that its actions did not violate international law protections for diplomatic missions," experts say. And then the next one is The Economist. "With its latest assassination, Israel is testing Iran. It is a dangerous game in a region already at war." So that's, I think, a helpful context.
Yeah, I mean, look, so the fact that it's being posed as a question is bombing an embassy complex allowed? The easiest way to recognize the double standard with which the media portrays things is to just reverse the language. There was actually, so that Economist headline was then later, after the Iranian response, there was another Economist headline, which started out with "Iran attacks Israel," right? A very, not using a passive voice, just very direct. And then it said something to the effect of, you know, risking the escalation of like a regional war. That is not the same way that Israel's action was described. That Israel's action by bombing an Iranian consulate or embassy complex could risk, especially in this context, a much larger war, an escalation, that it was a significant escalation. And when U.S. officials were asked this by press in press briefings multiple times, well, is this not an escalation? Of course, they avoided saying it. They said, well, you know, we have to see what was going on. We have to see, was it even a consulate? Like, everything becomes questioned. But immediately on the other side, if Israel does something, well, Israel said so. So that must be fact. It's fact. Israel says it. So the way that it's framed is problematic because you, again, if you're not following these things very closely, you might think, well, this attack came out of nowhere. Look, is Israel just being attacked by Iran? And that's not what happened. Something prompted it. On top of that, there was the fact that Iran had said that if the U.S. would allow, basically, if the U.N. would condemn Israel's action, then no response would be necessary. And again, Matthew Miller, State Department spokesperson, was asked this days before the Iranian response, right? He was asked the specific question, well, why, you know, then why aren't we just condemning this? And his response was, well, that's a flimsy excuse from Iran. If they don't want to escalate and they don't want to attack them, then they just shouldn't. That's just a decision that they should make. But then when the question is posed to him today about Israel's now, you know, this is now going back and forth about Israel's reaction, his response is, well, Israel's a sovereign state. It'll make that decision on its own.
I mean, the double standards like could not be more glaring. He would never say about Israel, well, why don't they not escalate? It's up to them to not escalate.
Yeah. Well, they won't even regard it as an escalation, right? It's framed just like everything else. It's just framed as self-defense. And what you have to assume, and this is sort of like the something we have to accept. What you have to assume if you accept the U.S. narrative is that Israel has never done anything wrong. Certainly not intentionally. They may have made a mistake here and there, but even that has no consequences, right? Because they admit their mistakes only when the entire world knows what happened and they're being condemned for it. And Israel's adversaries are always doing something wrong. That's the only way to make it make sense, that 100% Israel is in the right and 0% anyone else has the same right to self-defense. And whether that's a sovereign state like Iran or whether that is the Palestinian people who are occupied, no one has the right to self-defense except for Israel.
And everything they do is self-defense, yeah. We actually have a clip of Matthew Miller being asked about why it's so hard to determine whether Israel bombing of an Iran consulate was actually the bombing of an Iran consulate. Let's take a look at this clip.
Have you guys decided yet or made a determination about whether what Israel hit in Damascus was a diplomatic facility or not?
We have not. We have not.
So how long is this going to take?
I can't answer that question. We're continuing to look into it. I don't have a timetable, but it's something that we're...
What more do you need to...
We need to gather enough information that will allow us to make an actual determination.
You have no one on the ground in Syria.
We have arranged, as I said to you.
Remember, Syria, it was in Damascus, Syria, which is where the consulate was attacked.
When the last time you engaged with me on this question, we have a range of abilities, a range of ways to gather information. They're partner countries of ours who are on the ground. We have intelligence capabilities, obviously, and we're continuing to gather information, but we've not yet been able to make a determination.
I get it, but you were pretty quick into, you know, condemning the, you know, the invasion of the Mexican embassy in Ecuador.
That was a very clear, well-established embassy.
And this is not very clear where they blew up.
This is something that is taking a little bit more time.
No one died in that incident.
But that's not the question. The question was, what is it? Was it an embassy or a consulate or not? And it was very clear.
How hard is it to figure that out?
In the case of the Mexican, it's something that we're gathering information on.
It's been like 2 weeks.
And we continue to gather information. We don't have a determination.
So the Ecuadorian government invaded the Mexican embassy in Ecuador. Nobody was killed, and they rightfully condemned that. But then Iranians are actually killed in this strike. And they can't figure out whether or not it's worthy of condemnation.
A number of people were killed. If I'm not mistaken, there were Syrians that were killed as well. So this is a pattern. If you watch the briefings, what you'll see is whenever there's like a very obvious thing that Israel did, right? Because we know that Israel carried out an action that is deemed as a violation of international law. The Biden admin, the officials, won't answer the question. What they do is they evade it doing exactly what you just saw Miller do, which is we're still assessing. And this has been the case with they've been asked now repeatedly about, has Israel violated international law? And you saw a couple of weeks ago, John Kirby say, you know what our assessments show? Israel has violated no international law. And they're asked about this over and over again. And the response is there's ongoing assessments. What happens is it falls out of the news cycle, right? There's just ongoing assessments and it falls out of the news cycle. And then the next thing happens and there's ongoing assessments. But we're now more than 6 months into a war. It took the US, I think 10 days, maybe 10 days, to say that Russia was committing war crimes in Ukraine. 10 days. We're now more than 6 months into the war in Gaza and the US still cannot determine at all if a war crime or a law has been violated by Israel, even though there's so much blatant evidence that this has happened. All these other, they've even been asked, well, so are these human rights organizations and other NGOs that are on the ground, do they just not know what they're talking about? Are they all just making this up? And the response is, we're still assessing. And so you see that in this too. It's like, well, we're still assessing. And so there's a way of sort of throwing the question down another week, down another day until there's a new issue. And then that never comes up again.
Yeah. And yes, seven people were killed in that strike on Iran's Syria consulate, including two IRGC generals. So you did some more media analysis and corrections. Let's take a look at another headline that you fixed. So you took a screenshot from CNN. The headline says, as Iran attacks Israel, Biden confronts an escalating Middle East crisis he had hoped to avoid. And you tweak it. So it's after Iran's response to Israel's attack, Biden confronts an escalating Middle East crisis he helped to create. And then you point out Iran was responding to Israel's attack on its embassy. This framing makes it seem like Iran initiated an attack. And if Biden wanted to avoid a crisis, he would have supported a ceasefire. Instead, he gave Israel no red line, aided atrocities in Gaza, and shattered international law. And of course, as you pointed out earlier, the United States could have allowed for, I believe it was Russia who initiated a condemnation or tried to initiate a condemnation of Israel's attack on Iran. And the U.S., of course, blocked that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you really wanted to go back further in terms of why are we here, if you want to just look at this specific incident, yes, the U.S. could have allowed the condemnation, a U.N. condemnation against Israel. That doesn't, it's just a condemnation. It didn't mean that all of a sudden something was going to change on the ground. But even the rhetoric of Israel being condemned for an action that it takes against Iran is not something apparently that can be stomached by U.S. administrations. So you could have first prevented this specific thing from happening had you just allowed the international system to work the way it's supposed to. It's supposed to condemn Iran when it does something that violates international law. And that means it's supposed to condemn Israel when it does something that violates international law. But you could go back much further and say, well, what if the U.S. had actually supported the multiple ceasefire attempts that the U.N. has tried over these months? How many thousands of lives would have been saved in Gaza? And you could have avoided escalation, right? The escalation, that's the larger context. And they're just pretending like that's not what's happening here. So what if the U.S. hadn't vetoed a U.N. ceasefire resolution in December? What if even a month ago, when they finally abstained after having vetoed it three times, what if they didn't undermine it by calling it non-binding and just making up the fact that all of a sudden UN resolutions can be non-binding? So there's many things that the US could have done to prevent this escalating tension within the region. The Biden administration has chosen not to. So the idea that this is framed as he's tried to avoid conflict, how can you be avoiding conflict when the source of the conflict is something that you are funding and giving weapons to? And you can make a criticism of the entire sort of approach of the administration's foreign policy with the region. Another example of that would be, well, right now, now you hear murmurs of, and it's even worse because look, Iran's nuclear program has expanded. Well, who allowed Iran's nuclear program to expand? Iran was abiding by the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, that was an internationally recognized agreement negotiated by the United States under the Obama administration. It was the Trump administration that pulled out of that deal in 2018, and the Biden administration never went back to the deal, never resumed that deal. So if we're now in an even more dangerous situation, again, it is U.S. policies that have led us into that context, specifically of this administration. So, you know, they can sit here and say he was trying to avoid it. Nothing on the ground tells you that he was trying to avoid it. If anything, this admin has been fanning the flames by arming and funding and denying the role of the international community and the international system in preventing any of these things from happening.
Well, let's take a look at Matthew Miller condemning Iran's actions earlier this week.
And Iran launched an unprecedented air attack on Israel. Ultimately, the defensive effort to intercept Iran's drones and missiles was effective, successfully preventing what could have been a significant loss of life. This was a shared success, and the United States is proud to have played a critical role in it. Over the past 2 days following the attack, the President and the Secretary have consulted extensively with partners in the region and around the world. Secretary Blinken spoke yesterday with the foreign ministers from Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Germany, and the United Kingdom, and he continues to make calls with foreign counterparts today. We will continue to emphasize the importance that the international community act as a united front in condemning such reckless, escalatory acts. Such behavior threatens to destabilize the region and endangers all its people, and Iran's attack violated the sovereignty of several states in the region. I also want to be absolutely clear. The United States' commitment to Israel's security is sacrosanct. Our contributions to Israel's defense against Iran are a clear manifestation of that commitment. So too are our efforts to advance a ceasefire of at least 6 weeks in Gaza, which would secure the release of all remaining hostages and create a pathway to a more enduring peace. We remain committed to advancing that work and providing lasting peace and security for Israel, for the Palestinian people, and for the broader region. and we will continue to engage regional and international partners urgently on these areas in the coming days.
Wow, they care about sovereignty?
Yeah. I wish I had written down, like taken notes while he was talking, because almost every sentence he said was ridiculous. Sovereignty being one of them, right? Iran violated sovereignty, but Israel did not violate Syria or Iran's sovereignty when it bombed an embassy complex in Syria. He mentions the coordination with states like Jordan, I think he said Egypt. Well, the Jordanian foreign minister was interviewed by CNN yesterday. And first, he said that Iran had informed them they were going to that this attack was going to take place, which is probably what helped them intercept these missiles and drones. What he added, and this was the most significant thing, was that this is not about Iran. This is the Jordanian foreign minister saying this. This is not about Iran. This is about Gaza. Gaza is the focus of what's going on. Gaza is the instability in the region. Something else that Matthew Miller said, right? Iran is destabilizing the region, not Israel's genocidal war, but not its bombing of its neighbors, not its bombing of embassies. None of those things are destabilizing, but Iran's response is destabilizing. He talked about the unity of the international community. Laughable. Just the irony of saying that when the U.S. has stood alone against the international community and its wishes for months. It's just so brazen when you look at the language that they use when it's targeting an adversarial state and the language that they use when it's about an ally. Whereas that is not how international law works. That's not how law works, right? Laws don't work that way. If they did, I mean, I would like to say that they don't work that way. To a degree, we do see that, but that's what we call corruption, right? If the law does not apply equally to people, it's either prejudice or it's corrupt. And that's what we're looking at in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make this up. I don't know how he manages to say any of this with a straight face. It's kind of stunning. Let's take another look at Matt Miller. Sorry about all this, Matt Miller. I should have offered a trigger warning. And then we'll shift gears and watch another revolting person. So let's take another look at a Matt Miller clip.
But at a fundamental level, there is a bond between the United States and the people of Israel. And that bond rests on our shared security. And one of the things that we will continue to be committed to is the defense of that security.
And are you willing to risk a regional total war for this?
I think you've heard me say here a number of times that we are working to pursue de-escalation. And that has been the focus of our diplomacy since October 7th, not just over the weekend, but since day one, is trying to pursue de-escalation and prevent the conflict from widening and spreading and expanding.
Any thoughts on that statement?
Well, I mean, the idea that you're pursuing de-escalation while not supporting a ceasefire, right? Because what's creating the escalation is an ongoing, I have a difficult time even calling it a war, but like an ongoing slaughter in Gaza. So you have this genocidal campaign, and then you're saying, even in that statement that we saw previously, he said, we're advocates of a ceasefire, but small print, only 6 weeks, right? These temporary pauses that they're now framing as ceasefires, because when the international community is calling for a ceasefire, what they're asking for is a permanent one, right? They're saying this, the only way, I mean, the amount of destruction that has been, that Gaza has endured to rebuild that. And this was a report from several weeks ago. So every day it gets worse. But that report said it would take something like a decade, more than a decade, and tens of billions of dollars to recover, for Gaza to recover. The idea that a six-week pause is going to do anything, is going to make any dent in what is happening to the people there, is ludicrous. And so the way that it's talked about, we've always pursued de-escalation. If you wanted to pursue de-escalation, you would have supported a ceasefire. If you wanted to support de-escalation, you'd stop giving weapons to Israel. And if you wanted to support de-escalation, you'd condition something, condition weapons, condition military aid, condition something on signs that Israel is actually trying to de-escalate, not that it's still carrying out atrocities today, this morning. Today, there was reports of more children slaughtered by an Israeli missile from a drone hitting a playground, hitting a place, a group of kids playing.
It's self-defense, that's all, to hit kids at a playground.
That's today. But that's not what's going to be talked about today. What's going to be talked about today is, what is Israel's response to Iran going to be? That's what's going to be talked about today. Not the fact that more children, in addition to the thousands upon thousands of children that have been killed, that doesn't get the same amount of attention. So since you brought up Miller, I actually thought this was important too, because similarly, David Cameron, the British foreign minister, was asked in an interview, well, what would we do if a UK consulate was attacked?
Oh yeah, we have that clip. Let's take a look at that.
Yeah, that would be great.
So here's David Cameron, former English prime minister and current foreign minister. Here he is commenting on Iran's, unacceptable attack on Israel. Let's take a look.
Reckless and dangerous thing for Iran to have done. And I think the whole world can see all these countries that have somehow wondered, well, what is the true nature of Iran? It's there in black and white.
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
By the way, sorry, I can't help but say the true nature of Iran is to give a warning and not kill civilians and target the military. I mean, that's what I'm reading from what they did. Anyway, so we'll start from this from the beginning so everyone can hear it in all its glory.
Dangerous thing for Iran to have done. And I think the whole world can see all these countries that have somehow wondered, well, what is the true nature of Iran? It's there in black and white.
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
Well, we would take, we would take the very strong action.
And Iran would say that that's what they did?
Well, what they did, as I said, was a massive attack.
So they were right to respond, but they overreacted, is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that the attack they carried out was on a very large scale, much bigger than people accepted.
Right to respond.
Well, countries have a right to respond when they feel they've suffered an aggression. Of course they do. But look at the scale of that response. Had those weapons not been shot down, there could have been thousands of casualties, including civilian casualties. I think that's a really important point to take into account.
Wow.
Okay. So this was the point I wanted to bring up, because Miller said the same thing. He said, there could have been casualties. And so what you're seeing is a stronger condemnation and response from leaders like Miller, or from spokespeople like Miller and Cameron, about the potential for casualties that didn't happen. The attack is over. It didn't happen. Okay, so I love it because Miller always says, I can't respond to hypotheticals when people ask him things. He'll always say that. He's like, I'm not going to respond to a hypothetical. Well, hypothetically, that didn't happen. But you're putting a hypothetical in the past, not even the future, and saying that, but look at what could have happened. While thousands of people have been killed, tens of thousands of people have actually been killed, not a potential. We already know they've been killed, and they don't have a similar response. The only way to explain that is they do not think Palestinian lives matter in any way. Palestinians are not human beings to these people. Because how do you explain how it is a bigger deal for people to possibly have died that didn't die than the people who have actually died, who have actually been killed? So it's such bizarre language. And then the other thing is, this shows the nature of Iran. That's entirely racist, right? What does that mean? It shows the nature of who? The entire country? The entire 80 million people who aren't even represented by the government that they have? So what does the last 6 months show about the nature of Israel?
Yeah, which has a lot more of consensus than Iran does.
Absolutely.
I mean, in terms of what this is your area of expertise, which I'll ask you about, but in terms of diversity of opinion, right? There are a lot of Israelis who think that Netanyahu is not using enough force. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the range of opinion, besides an extremely, extremely small minority, which can get you locked up, like we saw in Israel, where a high school teacher posted something on Facebook somewhat sympathetic to Palestinians and then was locked up. But there's no diversity of thought, substantial diversity of thought, whereas there is in Iran.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If anything, in Iran, that sentiment would be reversed, because you would see a lot of people who take issue, a majority that actually take issue with the government is not representative of them. So the fact that someone like David Cameron would make that comment, that when you use language like that, when you say it's the nature You're saying it's the nature of a people, and it's unjustified, especially in a state where those people are not represented by the people, by the authorities that are making decisions for them.
It's also funny because, again, what did they do? What is the nature that they sent a warning, unlike Israel, that they targeted a military target, unlike Israel?
No, you could absolutely, in terms of the specific reference that he's making, that is also a really odd way of framing it, because it's like, well, what exactly is the nature of what you're talking about? They're responding to having been attacked with, you just said you would do too. Your nation state would do the same thing. And they telegraphed their response. They had days in advance. They were willing not to respond at all if there was simply a verbal condemnation by an international institution. So all of it, when you put it together, it's just mind-blowing.
It really seems to be it's like the nerve of a country, of a government, to respond, to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what's unacceptable.
Yeah.
Like, how dare they do anything and not just accept Israel's attacks and killings?
That's absolutely what it is, right? The idea is that Israel wants to have the right, and the U.S. and much of the Western world thinks that this is justified, that Israel should have the right essentially to conduct itself however it chooses, however it wants, and it is allowed to do so, and no one is allowed to respond. That's what we were saying earlier. There's no self-defense to anything that Israel does. Israel is 100% correct. It always has the right to self-defense. No one else has the right to self-defense. They are always in the wrong. And that dichotomy is honestly insane, if you think about it. If you think about it in any other situation, when would we accept that kind of absolutism in the way that we describe interactions between human beings?
Another story I wanted to bring up is actually something that broke in The Intercept, and we can take a look at the article. A really important story from The Intercept, which is about the way that certain words are banned at the New York Times. So it was a leaked New York Times memo, and here is what was revealed. So leaked New York Times Gaza memo tells journalists to avoid words genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory. Amid the internal battle over the New York Times coverage of Israel's war, top editors handed down a set of directives. And then if we go into the actual article, it says, the New York Times instructed journalists covering Israel's war on the Gaza Strip to restrict the use of the terms genocide and ethnic cleansing, and to avoid using the phrase occupied territory when describing Palestinian land, according to a copy of an internal memo obtained by The Intercept. The memo also instructs reporters not to use the word Palestine, except in very rare cases, and to steer clear of the term refugee camps to describe areas of Gaza historically settled by displaced Palestinians expelled from other parts of Palestine during previous Israeli-Arab wars. The areas are recognized by the United Nations as refugee camps and house hundreds of thousands of registered refugees. So this, of course, is extremely important because it's another example of how consent is manufactured, to put it in the Chomskyan terms. What are your thoughts on this, on these guidelines, on this memo?
Well, my initial thought is that it's not surprising, right? This is what I've been criticizing in, and many people have been criticizing in the media narrative. It's just that now you have hard evidence that it's not, you know, despite the denials, there's nothing to be denied. This is absolutely clear. If you follow the way that the media has the language that they use, it's obvious. It's obvious that this was happening. So it wasn't surprising at all. I was just happy that there was evidence to confirm what those of us who have been paying attention already knew, just they are absolutely intentionally and deliberately using this language to whitewash what Israel is doing, whitewash Israel's crimes, and to dehumanize Palestinians.
And you actually tweeted something about this. In response to this revelation, you tweeted out, people ask why I changed Gazans to Palestinians. You can see New York Times avoid saying it intentionally because it serves the Israeli goal of erasing the Palestinian national identity, which is inextricably tied to their struggle for self-determination. And then we see a bunch of headlines from you. So the first one, the New York Times headline says, Gazans describe search for food and wonder if it will get worse. And then you write, instead of Gazans, you write Palestinians. Okay, next one. To battle wartime hunger, Gazans turn to a humble leafy green. Displaced Gazans wonder where to go as Israel vows to keep pushing south. And you rewrite that as bombing anywhere they go. and 30,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza. Oh my God, that was the worst. This headline that was lives ended in Gaza. Lives ended in Gaza. You corrected that. 30,000 Palestinians killed. And then they wrote, since the war started, more than 30,000 people have been killed during Israel's bombardment and invasion. And you corrected that as Israel has killed more than 30,000 people during its bombardment and invasion. They really should hire you at the New York Times, but I will not be holding my breath.
Yeah, based on that memo, I'm going to say that I'm probably not writing in the style that they like. But that's, I mean, yeah, because there's a reason behind it. There's a reason why these issues are compartmentalized. There's a reason why we focus on Gaza as if Gaza is not tied to the West Bank, right? Settler violence in the West Bank is talked about separately than the war on Gaza. Evictions in East Jerusalem are talked about differently than settler violence in the West Bank. The Palestinian diaspora and the right of return is talked about separately. All of these issues are picked apart because it helps to erase the fact that this is a national identity. This is a nation, right? And that is very much what Israel has tried to do for decades, deny the very existence of Palestinians. And so when you see this language used in mainstream media, it affects the way that people think. It shapes the way that people think. And I hear this a lot of times. People will say things like, no one is paying attention to who reads the New York Times, People read the New York Times, people see CNN, people are seeing these things. And you see the results of that when you hear polling in the US, when you see a polling that shows people, half of Americans don't know if more Palestinians have been killed than Israelis. I mean, it's not, how do you end up that way? And again, you can criticize the population at large, but that seems extremely unfair. You should criticize the institutions that are meant to inform them, because you know that they are informing them incorrectly. That's why this framing is so important. And it's just, I mean, it's not, on one hand, it's not surprising, right? This like memo and this leak is not surprising at all. Cause like I said, it's absolutely obvious that this is what's happening, but it's still shocking. It's still shocking that you have something, this paper that has the notoriety of the New York Times, that is basically censoring. I mean, this is censorship. You're telling your journalists, don't use real words to describe things. How do you get away with that? In any other country, if someone was to say that, we would call it rightfully censorship. We would call it propaganda.
State media.
Absolutely. Because it's repeating and parroting whatever the state is saying. Right? An independent free media is supposed to question and challenge the state and its leaders, not parrot them.
So, Asala, someone who has written about Iran and Iranian identity, and again, just to remind viewers and listeners, your book is called The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran. What kind of context can you provide, or what understanding do you think is often omitted of kind of Iranian history and society?
Well, that's a huge question. So I will say one of the things that is often omitted in the narrative, there's a few things. One of the major things is the history sort of starts with the revolution of 1979 from the US perspective. Whereas obviously this is a country with a vast, like multi-thousand year history. But in terms of its contemporary and modern state, the 1953 coup that the US carried out, that the CIA along with the British carried out to remove the prime minister, Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iranian oil, who had helped to galvanize this democratization movement in the country in order to reimpose a dictator and a monarch who then turned around and repressed politically the Iranian system. Well, those are the roots that led to things like the 1979 revolution. Like how that history takes shape is based on these actions, foreign imposed in this case, specifically by the US in 1953. And that's really left out of the narrative. I always say one of the things that really informs the American psyche about Iran is the 1979 embassy seizure, right? The hostage crisis. This is something that paints a picture of what Iran is. And yet most people who think that are not aware of the fact that one of the roots of why that happens is also the 1953 coup, right? The Iranian revolution happens in February of 1979. The embassy is seized in November of 1979. This is 9 months apart. What happens 2 weeks before November 4th is that the Shah is allowed to enter the United States. And so one of the factors that pushed the students who seized the embassy to do so was the fear that there would be another coup, that the Shah would be reimposed again. So there are these histories that are, and mutual grievances that are completely missing within the narrative. And then in its contemporary form, I think there's just this attempt to sort of paint the entire country with one brush, as if 85 million people all agree on something. That is certainly not the case. There is a lot of diversity, religious, ethnic diversity, as well as political diversity within the country. And so I'm always weary of any individual or group who tries to speak on behalf of an entire population, because that's just not the case, just like it wouldn't be in any country, right? If one group tried to speak on behalf of all Americans, it would be misleading because it would certainly be leaving out a lot of diverse voices within the country, no matter what that group is. And so I would just suggest that we treat all states with the same, all nations with the same critical thinking, that this is a diverse group of people. They don't all agree and they don't all think the same way.
And what else? What other kind of myths do you think that there are that are worth debunking?
I mean, there's a lot of things that you could cover. I think one of the things that's very interesting is Iran is, and this is sort of an Orientalist trope, Iran is often depicted, the Islamic Republic specifically, is often depicted as this sort of all-powerful entity that's, you know, a puppet master, and it's everything that happens is Iran-backed, and they tell everybody what to do, and, you know, they've infiltrated our institutions, and this is the way that it's depicted. And at the same time, it's on the verge of collapse if we just slap on another sanction, right? Just a few more sanctions and they're very fragile and they're about to collapse. You know, the reality is somewhere much more in the middle. There's certainly domestic pressure within the country because there's a lot of dissatisfaction, especially among the youth, with the system entirely, with the system, the way it functions, its political repression, its social repressions. And of course, the dire economic situation in which they find themselves in, which is in part responsible for the state itself because of its mismanagement and corruption, but also because of U.S. sanctions, right? There's no way of disentangling the economic situation in Iran from the fact that it's under, up until 2 years ago, the heaviest sanctions of any country in the world. Right now it's Russia. So I think that sometimes those narratives and the reason why you can see these very extreme opposite narratives serve a purpose politically. And that's why we hear them, right? Iran is all powerful when we want to say they're the bad guys. Iran is very, very weak and on the verge of collapse when we want to advocate for things like regime change or more sanctions or more pressure policies. Whereas if we understood that there's something much more in the middle, then we would have policies in place that would actually understand how to interact with that state. And I'll give you one just concrete example, and I know we're running out of time. One of the discussions leading up to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in the US was that, and these were Iran hawks, right? The ones who didn't want any diplomacy with Iran. Iran couldn't be trusted. Iran will never negotiate with the US. Iran will never abide by a deal. These were very common sort of rhetoric that was used. We now have, as factual evidence, all of that is incorrect. Iran negotiated with the US, came to an agreement and abided by that agreement. And this was certified by both the Obama and the Trump administration, which pulled out of the deal. So that rhetoric doesn't match the reality on the ground. And it leads to situations that we find ourselves in today, which is you have an administration that pulled out of the deal. You have another administration, the Biden administration, which never went back to the deal. And now we have more tension with a country that is, whether we like it or not, one of the major powers within the region. And it exists and it's there. And this is the current government. And so, you know, we can live in a sort of fantasy that says this is not the reality on the ground, but it is. And in order to have peaceful coexistence, in order for our own national security interests to be served, we have to understand what's actually going on there.
Do you have time for another short clip?
Sure.
Okay, so this is from Fox News Sunday. This is a Knesset member being interviewed on Fox News.
By contrast, there are videos coming out of Iran of people there celebrating in the streets. I know that you have talked, though, about the fact that you believe the Iranian people, for the most part, are being oppressed. and that they actually need to be rescued from their own leaders. Is there any scenario in which that happens? Because there's been a stranglehold for decades on that country where the people who do attempt to step up and protest their leadership there meet oftentimes with very terrible ends.
Well, absolutely. I really hope that happens. It needs to happen as quickly as possible. The Iranian people need to be free of this oppressing and violent regime. I mean, if you look around the world, those marches that you see in support of Israel, the Jewish community are marching hand in hand with Iranian communities, with Iranian refugees, because they understand the real force and the real, the biggest instigator of terror in the Middle East and in the rest of the world, which is Iran. And we have a mutual goal, and it is to fight it together. I mean, Iran is attacking not just Israel. Iran is the most destabilizing force that we have. It's attacking our values. This is radical Islamist regime that's attacking our values, the way that we live, our liberties, our freedom, and it has to be stopped. If this attack from last night would have happened to any other country, the results would have been devastating with probably thousands of dead. And I think that that's a proof for the rest of the world how important it is for all of us to stand together against this violent and devil regime.
Well, we know Israel is facing threats on many, many fronts. Knesset member Sharon Haskell, we thank you for your time.
So, you know, here's the sort of dichotomy that we're accustomed to seeing in the Western narrative in general, which is good and bad. These are the good guys and these are the bad guys. And what's funny about it is it's not actually the actions that are being judged as to whether or not you're good or bad. Because if the point that's being made is, again, and you saw this in this interview too, Iran's attack could have killed civilians. It didn't. It could have. Well, if that's what deems you bad, then Israel seems like a super bad guy right now because they've actually killed thousands of people. The U.S. has unleashed many wars in the region. I think the numbers on the war on terror are something like just direct death is like 1 million people. If you look at secondary reasons for death, the number goes up. So it's not the actions that deems whether or not someone is the good guy or the bad guy in these absolute terms. It's just who it is. It's just there's a system of power that exists, and the state that's the biggest power, which is the U.S., deems itself the good guy. Anybody it wants becomes the good guy, and everybody doesn't like becomes the bad guy. And that's why you see this sort of disdain for international law and the international system. It doesn't really matter because what law is whatever we say, because we're the ones in power and we can make that decision. So it's not that I would say, and I would avoid this, and I think sometimes this happens, is the adversaries of the U.S. then become these like heroic figures. And I think that's problematic as well, because there are the Iranian people themselves have very legitimate reasons why they object to the current government. The problem is, if you want to hold the Islamic Republic accountable, you have to have a system of accountability. And we are the ones who are undermining that system of accountability as we speak. So one of the reasons why advocates of international law are so frustrated and so angry at what we've seen in the last 6 months is that you are watching the supposed champions of that system tear it to shreds. You cannot hold only selective states accountable. Everybody has to be held accountable under that system. And that's why it's so important to hold Israel accountable so that you can hold Iran accountable as well.
And of course, I would say sanctions don't help anyone.
Certainly not the way that they are used by the U.S., right? The broad-based sanctions that impoverished an entire, that amount to collective punishment are not an actual strategy that brings about the change, and they're not effective, right? They're effective in very specific situations, but most of the time, the way that sanctions are used are entirely ineffective, and they actually end up hurting the civilian population rather than their target, which is the leadership. And that's certainly been the case in Iran.
Well, Asal, thank you so much for joining. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And everyone follow Asal. Okay, so we are going to keep the show going. That was so great. And we have two more great guests. So excited to bring back onto the show Matthew Ho, a disabled Marine combat veteran for peace and a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy. In 2009, he resigned from his position with the State Department in Afghanistan in protest of the escalation of the war. He ran as a Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate to represent the people of North Carolina in 2022 and was sabotaged, of course, by the Democrats. Barry Reich is a retired carpenter and building inspector. He is also a Vietnam veteran, former national president of Veterans for Peace, and has been active in the anti-war movement in the Twin Cities and beyond for over 30 years. Engaging in this work, he has participated in delegations to Vietnam, South Korea, Cuba, and Mexico. As an environmental activist, he focuses on how the military is contributing to climate change. It is a life goal of his to leave the world a better place. So welcome, Matthew and Barry. Thank you so much for joining.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Hi, Katie. Good to see you.
You too. I want to ask each of you how you became Veterans for Peace. What turned you into Veterans for Peace? Did you have an aha moment? Was it a gradual process?
Yeah, it's kind of a long story. You know, as a young man, I went from the workhouse. You know, my life was on a downward trajectory. I went from the workhouse into the military, from jail to the military. So that's the way my life was going. You know, I was not awoke, you know, at that time. You know, in my era, you in high school, you either got drafted or you joined the military or you deferred. You know, I managed to screw that up. My folks thought it. But anyhow, I wasn't on a good path. I served time over in Vietnam and I regret, you know, I try not to be too hard on the soldiers that are doing the dirty work in Israel, because I've been on that side, you know, and I regret things that I've been involved with. But anyhow, but I came home disillusioned, but I wasn't awoke. And then in 1978, I got into recovery for alcoholism. And through that process, then I became awake, you know. So basically since 1978 forward, I just have become aware of what my country is doing, war, and I'm like a multi-issue person. I focused on war because that's what speaks the loudest to me. You know, and of course, now the environmental destruction of the climate crisis. So anyhow, and then 91, in our first incursion of Iraq, I found Veterans for Peace, and I've been actively involved ever since with that organization. So it tells the story, but that's it.
And what woke you up after you were in treatment, you said, for alcoholism?
Best I can describe it is I was asleep. I wasn't, you know, it was like spiritual awakening, you know, and it became conscious. I just was not conscious. It's just like the people that are, you know, following the media today. They're asleep. I was talking to a gal the other day that did, and I was trying to make a medical appointment. She said, Gaza? What do you mean, Gaza? I mean, she didn't even know the word, you know. And so she's not awake, you know. Most of the American public is not awake, in my opinion.
And what about you, Matt?
Yeah, it's similar to what Barry was saying. And I think there's probably a connection there in terms of the stopping the alcohol that allows you to at least entertain the thoughts of what you knew, you know, what you took part in, you know, to burst the bubble into, you know, because what I found for myself was, well, I went to Iraq the first time and I thought the war was screwed up and was a mistake, but I thought I could make a difference. I thought like I could be a moral actor in the war. And that was just, you know, complete folly. You know, the war made me an agent of its immorality. And then, you know, you lie to yourself, you make excuses. You know, I went back a second time because I thought I could bring home guys alive. I was a better officer than others. And then, then I'm at that point morally and intellectually broken for taking part in those wars. But you know what? I'm a piece of meat and I might as well just continue this. And so I went to Afghanistan, and then seeing Afghanistan was no different than Iraq. I think that was the great hope I had, that somehow Afghanistan was going to be different than Iraq. And of course, everything I knew from reading history and everything else I knew about previous American, what the American Empire had done overseas as well here on this continent. But that was in the past. It wasn't connected. You know, my generation wouldn't be making these mistakes, right? You know, not mistakes. But anyway, and then but being in Afghanistan, seeing that there was no fundamental difference between Iraq in the Afghan wars, no fundamental difference between the Democrats pursuing and escalating the Afghan war and the Bush administration, creating, invading and occupying Iraq. So For me, it was that it was gradual. I resisted it. I lied to myself. I made excuses. And then one of the things was, though, you know, before I went to Afghanistan, I was, suicidal, and I was drinking heavily to deal with the moral injury of being a part of those wars. And I think what happened, one of the reasons why I was able to see Afghanistan clearly and allow myself to accept that what I was taking part in was wrong, what I was doing, I was being intellectually and morally dishonest with myself, was the fact that I wasn't able to drink in Afghanistan. I wasn't able to like numb myself, right? I wasn't able to like bring myself down to the level where I thought I should be because of alcohol. And I was able to have these thoughts, right? Because back home in between the wars, you know, I would just medicate and punish myself with alcohol. And the same thing continued after the wars, of course, until I got help for it. But, you know, so I resigned from my position in the State Department in Afghanistan at that point in 2009. And that brought me into connection with Veterans for Peace and other anti-war and peace groups. And it's, you know, I think some of it is you ask yourself when you're in these wars, when you're coming out of them, when, you know, when you're dealing with this moral injury of what you've done, what you've participated in, you know, one of the questions is, what was it for? And then you find yourself having nothing else. And what is your life for? And then you find like an organization like Veterans for Peace, you find guys like Barry, and like, holy, you feel this way too. You want to blow blow your head out because of what you did. And, but now I can do something about it, and I can atone, I can repent, I can be better, and I can be around you all, you understand. And so, yeah, VFP, Veterans for Peace, you know, it's not hyperbole to say that for a lot of us, it gave us our lives back.
That's really moving and fascinating that you had such parallel tracks, even though you're such different wars and different times.
Yeah, absolutely. See, I mean, you go to your substance abuse treatment at the VA, you go to your PTSD treatment at the VA, and you're in these group therapies with these guys that are, you know, 30 years older than you, right? You know, nothing in common except that you went to war and you regret it. And, you know, thank God you're in those groups because, you know, you're there with people who get it and people who get you, and they're willing to give you a chance. And because these guys understand and they're willing to give you a chance, you're willing to give yourself a chance, right? And, you know, but, you know, we all know that the aspects of veterans and the high rates of suicide, and a lot of that particular combat veterans have to do with this moral injury from taking part in wars, regretting it, the shame, the guilt, but then not having any way to heal from that. And so that's how you, way you heal is you be around other guys who did the same sins that you did.
Wow. So what are your thoughts on what is happening right now in Gaza, but also Iran as veterans? How do you see this conflict going?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, just everything that Ali, was it
Assal.
I mean, it just was so right on the money. I mean, you know, Matt kind of directs us to just figure out a couple of things that drive us crazy, you know, but the lies and the distortion, it just is, you know, Israel bombs, you know, and then Iran very, you know, openly, you know, let's say we're going to respond. And then the headlines of the New York Times, oh yeah, well, Iran dropped the bomb, but nothing about following Israel. You know, so anyhow, it just drives me crazy. It's just, you know, then one thing leads to the next escalation. You know, there's no end to these things. You know, I mean, ultimately, in Ukraine didn't need to start. This didn't need to start. You know, without U.S. supplying the weapons and the soldiers doing the dirty work, it didn't have to happen. It just absolutely doesn't. And it just drives me crazy that the death and suffering of the children, especially, just pulls at my heart every day. And that's, you know, what keeps me involved the most, you know. I've tried to do something every day since October 7th. Anyhow, as a former soldier, I try, and like I say, I know I've been on that side too. You know, there's people that are doing the dirty work, and it's not that now, you know, and those soldiers are going to have to live what they participated. That's no, you know, there's no escaping that. There's just no escaping it. They're burning their souls, you know. So that's my words a little bit.
And what about you, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, so I was able to go to Palestine on a Veterans for Peace delegation in 2017, went to the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And, you know, that's the occupation. And seeing that for those of us who had not been, who had taken part in our occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, that was holding a mirror up to our face. And so for those of us who, you know, who went on that delegation, who understood the history, and we understood what was going on there, and we had our opinions on it, but to have that personal experience of seeing these Israeli soldiers doing what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, kicking in doors, going to people's homes, having the checkpoints, right? You know, humiliating people, having that power over people, right? As well as the abuse, the oppression, you know, and then what we're seeing here in Gaza, of course, I think Barry's point about the lies, you know, so the same lies that sustained Vietnam, the same lies that sustained Iraq and Afghanistan that created it, you see it again. And so you recognize the same people. I mean, you know, and it actually is the same people, right? In terms of for the Americans, it's the same people in charge who are, you know, I don't want to even call what's happening with the U.S. role in Gaza as being complicit or supportive. The U.S. is a participant. And I mean, it's so fully involved. The only thing is that we don't have our kids pulling the triggers. Other than that, we are basically doing everything else. We're a full participant. But the people who are running this war then, who are running this genocide, more or less the same people that, you know, for the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Libya, et cetera. I mean, so it's the same people. And if the Republicans were in power, won't it just be their tranche? So I think that's for us, a lot of what we see, it's like holding a mirror up to our faces. And then, of course, the knowledge of what these weapon systems do, what it's like. Many of us have seen dead children. Many of us have been around this, you know, I mean, so you know what that's like. But then too, the idea that so much of this, you know, the Israelis could not be doing it without us, you know, so all those bombs that are getting dropped there, those are American bombs. All those warplanes, those F-35s and F-15s and F-16s, those are all American warplanes. So I think there's the host of things that we see in terms of our roles that we did, and now just being played out in front of us again.
And do you think this is going to escalate?
You want me to respond?
Go for it, Barry.
I think I personally feel that this is what Biden wanted for forever, you know. You know, I don't think they're trying to avoid anything. They're pushing it along as far as I'm concerned. And for whatever reason, you know, I mean, if we wanted to stop, we'd stop. You know, like the guy that was talking about, we're working at, you know, we're moving the Navy in. I suspect on our flotilla, we're probably going to run into some Navy ships. They're moving, you know, immediately we got to respond. You know, there's never, hey, where's the Department of Peace? Or where's the Department of Negotiating? Maybe we should sit down and take a look at this before we respond in some aggressive manner. You know, where is that? We just don't do that. You know?
Right. I think there are those within the Israeli government, most of the ruling coalition, that wants this to escalate. First of all, for those who are in favor of the continuation and the entering the final phases of the greater Israel project of Zionism, this is the best opportunity they've had and the best opportunity they're going to get. So carry it out. In order to do that, you need to have these threats, right? As well as what we're seeing this week, nobody's paying attention to what's happening in Gaza. So if you can have these distractions, as well as then you can make it seem as if here goes into the trope of Israel up against all these enemies who surround them, who want to destroy them. So what few Democrats you had who were suggesting they weren't going to really ever do anything about it, but suggesting that we should condition arms sales to Israel based upon human rights violations, which already is United States law through like five different laws, as well as, of course, all the international treaties and conventions we're a part of. But anyway, you know, this has removed all that. Right. So we have to give Israel everything they need because they're being attacked by the Iranians, you know. I think the escalation serves political purposes in Israel. It serves certainly ideological and militarist purposes in Israel. I think the Biden administration, though, is horrified at the idea that it does escalate and that they're faced with $5 a gallon gasoline during a campaign. That would effectively destroy Joe Biden's reelection chances. I mean, he's doing a great job by himself, right? But, you know, I mean, So, I mean, but the White House is also trapped because this relationship with Israel is structural. You know, even if Joe Biden was to wake up tomorrow and he could end this by calling Netanyahu and saying, it's over, you're not getting anything else from us. Well, the next day, the Congress would begin to impeach him. You know, I mean, so it's a structural issue where because we have this system of legalized bribery, the Israeli lobby is able to control our political system, just in the way that pharma does and big ag does and the banks do and the military industrial complex does. So, yeah, I mean, I can see this escalation continuing to happen. And then, of course, you have the dangers of where does it go? And it's not hyperbole to talk about World War III. Syria, which is, you know, a key ally of Iran, which Israel bombs continuously. That's the proximate cause of Iran's attack on Saturday was Israel's attack on Iran's consulate in Damascus. Well, what's also in Syria? Russian troops and American troops. And I mean, so this idea that this could get to a point where you have, you know, World War III, that's not hyperbole.
Could you give an overview of all the wars that the United States is involved in? I mean, not that we have time for all of them, but just some of them.
Oh, gosh. You know, I mean, one thing I will say is that since 1991, according to the Congressional Research Service, the United States has been engaged in 250 military operations overseas. So you can look at it that way. In its sense of the wars, since 9/11, according to Brown University Cost of War Project, the United States has had troops in combat in close to 20 countries. I think it's 18 or 19. So in the last 20 years, we've had kids or young men and women in foreign countries, and 18 or 19 of them killing and being killed. I mean, so the scale of this in my lifetime, I was born in 73. If you look at, say, go from Western Africa all the way through South Central Asia, all the way to Pakistan, I don't know if there are any countries that haven't been touched by the wars. And then, of course, you know, Ken Klippenstein at The Intercept had a great article a couple of days ago where he talked about what happened over the weekend. And he's able to map it out so that there's 16 countries involved in the current fighting in the Middle East. You know, so whether it's, you know, Yemen or Israel or you know, Hezbollah and, you know, those type of things. Of course, the Americans, the British, the French, but then also, too, you have a lot of other countries like, say, Oman, which is where the U.S. Navy ships go all the time. The U.S. Navy ships that are firing missiles into Yemen are docking in Oman all the time. I mean, so 16 countries are involved in this. So the idea that as the U.S. media and our politicians want to portray as this simply being a very binary fight of good versus evil, right, of civilization versus barbarism, right? You know, you can get into all other things of just Israel versus Iran. You know, that is so far from the truth.
Yeah, look at our nation's history. I saw a listing once that just since this nation was founded, the amount of wars. I mean, it's like, you know, 6 years or something that we haven't been at war since this country was founded. Yeah, it's just unbelievable.
Well, shifting gears a little bit, although it's, of course, related, tell us about this flotilla that you're both involved in. I believe, Matt, you are helping coordinate, and Barry, you're actually going on a boat to Gaza. Can you talk about what this project is, what you guys are doing, and what you hope to achieve?
Yeah, well, Israel does not own Gaza. And they've been, you know, they're occupying, illegally occupying that part of the world. And they've had a siege going on there as far as aid coming into that country for 17 years. And so numerous boats have gone already before challenging that siege. And, you know, they've been dangerous missions, and typically they haven't gotten through to where they want to go. And most often they're detained, arrested, and deported. One year, I think it was in 2000, where they actually boarded a ship and killed 10 people. But what they've done over the years is they sink the boats. The aid doesn't go where. So we're just a continuation of that. It's just a different situation because there's the genocide happening there. But we, you know, we got 5,500 tons of aid on a separate boat. It's the International Freedom Flotilla Coalition. It's a coalition from around the world. We're going to gather in Istanbul and do 3 days of training. And Matt's going to be our media guy. And then we're going to take the boat, but we don't know what's going to happen. Once we went to get to Gaza or to wherever their boats confront us or whatever they come don't confront us. But we said, we don't want to just deliver it. Of course, we want to deliver the aid, but we want to break the siege. This is another attempt because Israel is illegal, and that our country allows them to be in charge of humanitarian aid is insane. I mean, we're talking about all the other insane. Why would Israel be in charge of the humanitarian aid? Come on, tell me that. They just gave us a legal thing about it. And I'm not a criminal. You know, for customs or somebody to start questioning me what I'm doing, I'm trying to help save life, man. And I'm trying to do a good thing here. And the no media, we put out press release all over town. Nothing. It's not newsworthy. You know, and I went to my local reporter the day that the aid workers were killed. I went to my reporter and said, hey, a group of us are going this month to deliver some aid. And we're aid workers. No story there, you know. But I said, I suppose if we get shot, you know, then there'll be a story, you know. But anyhow, so we're, you know, I desperately want, you know, I just been envisioning since October 7th what's going to happen to Palestinians. And that just kills it, breaks my heart, you know, seeing these children and the people suffering and dying and starving to death. It's just so ungodly cruel. And I can't stand it. And so this is just, to me, one more attempt to try to stop the madness. And we just hope that, you know, something good will come of it. That's my pitch.
I mean, it's scary, though, because as you referred to, they did try this before and people were killed. And nothing happened to Israel.
Nothing. And impunity, just like Trump, you know, never a consequence. You know, impunity, you know, and then the lies and the lies. And it just drives me out of my mind, you know. And then people take it, you know, cutting the funding to UNRWA, you know, right after the ICJ gives them, hey, you better got to clean up your act. Then what do they do? Well, then they cut the, they say, oh, there's 12 workers in Hamas and UNRWA. So then there goes UNRWA. Oh, timing, huh?
Even if that were true, which there's no evidence of that, but that would mean that 0.002% of UNRWA did something criminal. Whereas a much greater percentage of the IDF has committed crime, so we should be defunding them.
Exactly.
And posting TikTok videos of it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's the thing. Like, there actually is evidence of this.
Yeah.
And there's no repercussions for them, but there is for allegations that have no evidence, and except for some unreliable confessions elicited through torture. And Matt, what's your role in this going to be?
Oh, I'm just administrative. I'm not even leaving North Carolina. So I shouldn't be in this conversation, but, you know, I mean, what you're seeing, though, is you're seeing people like, you know, men and women like Barry, who are witnessing this genocide, witnessing this ethnic cleansing, these war crimes, this deliberate starvation, and saying, I'm not going to accept that. And they're compelled to do something. So they're getting on this boat with all that aid. More than 5,000 tons of aid, which, to give people an idea how much that is, because you say that to me, I'm like, I don't know. But the World Central Kitchen, Jose Andres's people that went in with their boat, they had 200 tons of aid. So this is a quite enormous amount. And what, you know, no one has taken this cavalierly. No one has taken this lightly. Everyone involved knows the Israelis have already killed almost 200 humanitarian aid workers. But, you know, these men and women are you know, how can they stand by? You know, how can you stand by? How can you do nothing? And that's what you hear from when you talk to people like Barry and all the others. We've got approximately 40 Americans who are going on this. You know, when you talk to them, that's what they all say. It's not like they got together and planned their response. This is how they feel. How can I stand by and do nothing? And, you know, and to Barry's point, it's just one illegal act after another. So every time the Israelis stop these ships, they do it in international water. They commit hijackings, basically. Right. I mean, so it's not even like but that's the Israelis. They have no care for international law. They have no care for public opinion, no care for what the world thinks of them. As long as they have the United States under control, and as long as they can count on the United States backing them, including, you know, the reserve currency of the U.S. dollar, the world's reserve currency, they can be Fortress Israel. And they're in this position now, as we were saying earlier, where this is the best opportunity they're going to get. And they are conducting this ethnic cleansing, this genocide. And so, yeah, these men and women like Barry are going to do something about it.
We hope something positive will come of it. You know, like I say, in the past, they've sunk the ships and took the aid, you know.
Yeah. And to be clear, this is not, no one is no one is viewing this as a suicide mission. None of these people are, I'm going to martyr myself. There's none of that type of false bravado. But these are serious men and women, serious people who realize that they can do something about this. And, you know, and the idea being is, how will the world respond? You know, so when members of Congress realize that they've got constituents who are trying to bring food and medicine into Gaza, and the Israelis are stopping them, you know, the Israelis have the ability to stop these boats, of course, you know, and then detaining them and arresting them and putting them in an Israeli prison, what are American congressmen and women going to do? I think most of us know the answer, but it's the point of it, to what Barry said, you know, it's about breaking the siege.
Yeah, by the way, I did deliver kind of on Matt's motivation there. I visited my Congress and Senate today and delivered a letter, you know, asking for your granting us safe passage and respecting my rights, you know, as public citizen to, I have a right to do, and expecting you to be at my back on this, you know, and expecting you to use what power you have to make sure we get safe passage.
Right. And that's a good point that Barry makes. I mean, they are, international law is on their side, right? And not only is that, but also we have the orders from the International Court of Justice from January and March ordering that everything be done to remedy this humanitarian catastrophe that's occurring because of Israel's, you know, genocide, their deliberate starvation, their siege, etc.
I mean, was Anne right on the Mavi Marmara? Is that was the ship, right? That,
yeah,
the Jason boat.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the Mavi Marmara was the one where people were killed, where the Israelis actually boarded, right, and killed people.
Yeah, they killed nine on the spot, and then another person died a few years later, and that was 2010.
And were they all Turkish people who were killed?
No, one was an American.
Oh, really? One was an American. Yeah.
And what do you think the Obama administration did?
Yeah, what
did
they do? Obama, no. The good one.
Yeah, exactly.
The president, right?
He wore a beige suit. And so, you know, everyone got upset. Yeah.
Because I was going to say, I mean, having veterans, I'm hoping will, and Americans, but being an American doesn't always work, obviously, as we know with Rachel Corrie and Shireen Abu Akleh and this person who you just mentioned. But maybe having Americans on the ship, having veterans, will provide, I'm hoping, some kind of layer of protection. I mean, it shouldn't be that way, obviously. I mean, it's a disgusting thing that certain people's lives are worth more because of their nationality. But we know how Israel works.
One of the leaders is Palestinian. I can't say her name. Matt, maybe you can. She's just really a great gal, though.
But she way to interrupt. She's actually Israeli. She has Israeli citizenship. So. To the Palestinian Israeli, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very, very, you know, I've just seen in Zoom some of the people, but it's going to be a really, really great group of people. You know, I think it's just going to be an honor just to be a part of this thing, yeah, whatever comes of it. And yeah, it's like one of the things that pushed me. I'm not a brave person. I'm not a hero. You know, I've had to work through a lot of fear, and I had used Matt for consulting board. But one of the things that pushed me over was, it's not a suicide mission. And I thought we were going to be on that aid boat. And I said, well, shoot, how do they know what's on that boat? They're going to just drop a bomb on us, you know? They're saying they could lie about it, you know? They would disappear as well. Yeah, so to know that that boat is separate from the passenger boat, that was helpful.
So you guys are taking some precautions.
Some precautions.
Yeah, there's a lot of precautions. And of course, can't talk about it, right?
Sure.
But to Barry's point, though, about the group, it is an amazing group, and it's young people, older people, it's Jews, Christians, Muslims, it's people who have have family in Palestine, who've lived in Palestine, people who didn't know about this issue until 6 months ago, and people who are engineers, and people who are lawyers, people who are doctors. I mean, just there's just the range of diversity in this group. It's really remarkable. I think when the American people, when they hear about this, if best case, of course, is the ships are able to land and to bring their cargo ashore. And there's plans to do that. I know people are saying, how is it going to happen? But there's plans to do that. But if it does happen where the Israelis do, hijack these ships and detain, you know, our fellow citizens, I think Americans are going to be very surprised at the type of people who went on this. These are not, you know, the long-haired hippie weirdos people think, you know. I mean, like, nothing wrong with long hair or being a hippie weirdo, but I think everyone knows what I'm talking about in a sense of kind of like the attitude in this country towards people who care about these types of things and do these kinds of things.
Well, any final words from either of you for tonight? I don't mean, you know, that sounded overly dramatic. Anything else you want to make sure we get into discussion? This has been really great and really helpful. And thank you so much for joining.
I just want to thank you for giving us air. Like I say, we're not getting a whole lot of, I did a Minnesota News Network, and that's been about it locally here, you know, outside of the groups that we're involved with, all the coalition of Free Palestine groups and stuff like that. I really appreciate you giving us some time to talk about it and any kind of support, you know. Yeah, just, you know, prayers and whatever. I got a Native friend who I said, I want you to pray for me, Strong Buffalo. And he did 34 tobacco ties, and they put them in a pack for me. So I'm going to wear those around my neck, you know. But I take all the support we're going to get. Yeah, I appreciate you. It's been a long time to be on here.
Oh, of course. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Katie. And if people want more information, they can go to the website. Freedom Flotilla Coalition is the overall coalition. There's 12 nations that are a part of this. And then the U.S. delegation, the website is U.S. Boats to Gaza. So Freedom Flotilla Coalition or U.S. Boats to Gaza. And those are also the same Twitter names. So people want to follow on Twitter. And there's plans to ensure that people are able to follow the progress of the boats as this mission goes out, as this emergency mission, it gets put underway.
Yeah, that's hopefully the world will be able to witness this on some level. You know, they got people with drones and, you know, whatever happens with the Israeli commandos or whatever, it's going to be, until they board the boat or would do something, it's going to be, that's my understanding, anyhow, that we're going to be monitoring their behavior.
Good. Yeah, definitely needs that. Well, thank you so much, Barry and Matthew. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.